a look at how technology changed in a decade, and why your inbox is suddenly flooded with privacy policy updates, plus how refugees made a small town in Maine feel like home. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, December 30th. Good to have you with us. The days between Christmas and New Year's can be a little slow on the economic news front, but we do have some new data out today. The U.S. trade deficit in goods, that's stuff as opposed to services, shrank for the third straight month in November. So we now have the smallest merchandise trade gap in 3 years. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports on why that gap is shrinking and how it relates to that thing we've been talking about all year, the trade war.
Imports fell because businesses are uncertain. That's according to Bill Watson at the think tank the R Street Institute. He says phase one of the U.S.-China trade deal isn't in the books yet. So
what we see here is potentially American importers responding to the trade war by decreasing the amount of business that they're doing.
He says businesses haven't seen the fine print of any of the pending trade deals the White House is trying to get done in the new year, but if and when they do,
hopefully we'll see less of that as importers have a clearer picture of what it is that they'll be able to import and from where and at what price.
He says U.S. buyers might have been anticipating that tariffs would roll back on products they were looking to import from China, but only a few, including cell phones, laptops, and video game consoles, were spared a tariff increase earlier this month. And Watson says ever since the trade war with China began, U.S. importers have been putting a lot of effort into finding other duty-free places to get their stuff from, instead of focusing on business as usual.
It reduces productivity and has major downstream effects that we may not see right away. But will certainly develop over time, especially if the trade uncertainty continues and compounds.
Robert Scott at the Economic Policy Institute says these numbers show that clouds are gathering on the global economic horizon.
Some slight reduction in the trade deficit is a reflection of the fact that the economy is not growing as fast as it was in 2018 or earlier in 2019.
The Commerce Department will release full international trade data next week, including for services, where the U.S. normally runs a surplus. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
If you've been noticing a slew of emails with updates to our privacy policy in the subject line lately, here's one reason why. On January 1st, Wednesday, the California Consumer Privacy Act, or CCPA, goes into effect. It's a California data privacy law, yes, but some companies plan to apply their new policies nationwide. The law lets people opt out of the sale of their personal information, but businesses are still trying to figure out exactly what that means and how to implement it. Marketplace's Jack Stewart has more.
At its most basic, the CCPA says companies have to show you all the data they collect on you for free twice a year, if you ask. You can request they not sell it or even delete it. Mary Stone Ross at the Electronic Privacy Information Center is one of the authors of the law.
Its basis is transparency. So I, as a Californian, can go to any business and say, what do you know about me? What do you know about my devices? And what do you know about my children?
Businesses, though, report they've only had a few months to figure out how to deal with those requests, and they're finding it tough. Sarah Jodka's with the law firm Dickinson Wright. She says she gets questions from clients about whether they need a web form or if they have to read a privacy notice before phone conversations.
I'm working with probably over 150 to 200 companies just on this issue. I get weird questions day in and day out.
The law applies to big companies with at least $25 million in revenue, but also those that have information on over 50,000 customers. And that could mean small firms with things like email sign-up lists end up being included. Jessica Malugin's at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
This sort of approach of one-size-fits-all regulation hasn't gone very well where they've tried it in Europe. There's actually been a huge increase in market share for the biggest players.
Big firms have the resources to absorb the costs. But Mary Stone Ross, co-author of the law, says some companies are using their confusion about it as an excuse.
I don't think it's a criticism of the law. I think there are some businesses that are earnestly trying to comply. And then I think there's other businesses that are trying to do the minimum.
The California Attorney General isn't going to start enforcing the law for 6 months. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
And just keep in mind, every one of those emails is some business that has data on you it may have been shopping around up until now. Just food for thought. On Wall Street today, while it's been a record year for the markets, it wasn't really a great day for them. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. With just 2 days left in 2019, we're looking back at the decade that was and how the economy has changed. It certainly was a big decade for tech, in issues like data privacy, like Jack was just telling us, but also in tech innovation. I'm joined by Marketplace tech host Molly Wood to hear about what happened and what to keep an eye on for next year. Hi, Molly.
Hey, Kimberly.
So let's start by looking back at the decade. What was the defining trend of the 2010s in tech?
So I'm going to say something that may be a little unexpected and it's going to sound a little bit boring. But if the early 2000s were sort of about the rise of the internet, right? The power of the internet, the 2010s were really about how to use it. And so the actual defining technology of the decade was software.
Mm-hmm.
What that meant was you saw this gradual shift away from things and widgets and devices and toward businesses that were built on a digital product that you could write once and sell millions of times. And that was hugely transformative. It meant that businesses were so much cheaper. And so that led to, you know, software as a service, which is incredibly profitable, platforms, and then this idea of marketplace businesses, no pun intended, that connect users with something that they want. And so on Facebook, that could be the social media part of it that also connects users to apps. Or in the case of Uber, it was an app, a piece of software that connected, you know, drivers to riders. And then that just led to the other defining trend of the 2010s, which was hyperscale business growth, businesses that just went from zero to 60 faster than you could even imagine.
Right. And of course, it's also the decade where these tech companies that you just described went from kind of like, oh, wow, this is so cool, to, oh, my gosh, you're all secretly evil.
Right. Which, you know, in some ways, when you think about it, was a little bit inevitable, because any organism that grows at that rate and gets that big sort of consumes everything around it. And, you know, the things that we saw these companies consume included our privacy and our jobs and our election security. We saw that algorithms that we thought had so much promise, artificial intelligence, could actually discriminate against us, could bake in our own biases. We saw that the driverless cars that were promised, you know, to save so many lives caused several deaths. And so it was sort of like the inevitable realization that there's a downside to everything. It's just that we didn't really realize that until these companies were so big and so powerful that now we're not sure what to do.
Okay, but can I have like an optimistic take of the 2010s in tech?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think in so many ways, our lives did get better. Like, what we often focus on is that we traded so many things for convenience, that we traded our privacy, we traded our attention. But the conveniences are real. I mean, this technology has brought jobs, mobility, access. And, you know, look, I think there is something to be said for the fact that I can use a smart device to order groceries to be delivered straight to my home so that I can do my homework with my kid. And I think you're right to say it's easy for us to look at only the bad side when this is technology that we're all using and we like it. For the most part.
For the most part. All right, then let's look ahead to the next decade. What are the technologies and business trends that you're keeping an eye out for the first few years of the 2020s?
Well, for one thing, I think that the money situation is going to change in tech, at least in these early years, right? You know, we've seen almost unlimited funding in venture capital. We've seen things like SoftBank with its huge $100 billion venture capital fund that really, I think, distorted the tech industry, created a lot of companies that people might have gotten used to, like WeWork. And I think some of that is going to change. And so you may see that technology development gets a little more efficient and that we may not see so many startups. It might not be such a busy unicorn factory. And if I had to make one crazy prediction, it would be that by 2030, let's say, no one will actually be carrying a phone.
What?
That's over. Yep, we're moving. It's going to be all ambient computing. So computing that's all around us and that's speech activated, mm-hmm. and that we still need this sort of like central hub for control. But that could be a wearable. That could even be glasses. It could even be implants. But I think this thing where we all have text neck because we're looking down at this dumb piece of glass, we're going to move on from that.
The host of Marketplace Tech, Molly Wood. Thanks so much, Molly.
My pleasure, Kimberly.
Another bit of California news. Starting January 1st, every newly built home there must include solar panels. The state has some of the most aggressive plans in the nation to tackle climate change. Globally, Spain is trying to take a leading role on this issue, but the country hasn't always been a role model when it comes to cutting carbon. Thanks to new legislation, that's beginning to change. The BBC's Tim Smith reports.
Jordi Benegas herds his flock at his farm in the rolling, craggy hills of the Spanish countryside, where the sun beats down hot upon his neck. But now Jordi is harnessing that natural energy as he looks to a greener future for his business. Jordi shows me around the processing room where his sheep's milk is turned into cheese. This year, Jordi launched a crowdfunding campaign, raising 7,000 euros to install solar panels to power these machines.
The system is that we've been making the cheese with power from butane gas canisters. That's why we wanted to mount the solar panels. We want to produce the cheese more sustainably, with solar and no contamination. In previous years, with previous governments in Spain, there was a tax on solar energy. Now they've got rid of that, and when you install solar panels, you no longer pay any fees.
And Jordi isn't the only one taking advantage of cheaper solar energy. Following the changes to regulation, 2019 has seen a huge jump in the number of solar panels installed in Spain. If you imagine these beeps as being the average rate of solar panel installation in the previous decade, this is how it compares to this year. Well, one of those installations is happening here, at a residential property in the northeastern Spanish town of Orias. Workers are drilling, laying cables and ratcheting up bolts as they secure a line of 16 solar panels in the garden. Mark Clemente is an operations manager for green energy company Olaluz, who are overseeing the work. I asked her what changes she'd seen this year.
The numbers speak for themselves, right? We can take the example of England, for example. In the UK, we would have around 800,000 panels, while the number in Spain, the equivalent number is 10,000 panels, which gives us a reference of the huge difference.
So how has one of Europe's sunniest destinations come to lag so far behind its neighbours in solar energy?
Well, it's ridiculous because I believe
Javier Creos is the founder of business and policy consultancy Ideas for Change. He told me how the problem goes back to the late 2000s and José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero's socialist government.
Zapatero's government gave subsidies to solar installations, basically big solar installations, with a promise of return on those investments. When they realized that the solar energy was not price competitive with nuclear or carbon or whatever, they shut down those subsidies.
So after those subsidies were removed, a lot of these companies investing in solar, their business model collapsed. And then later on in 2015, we had what was called the sun tax.
Mm-hmm. That was an absurd thing done by conservative government. It basically said, even if you produce your own energy through solar panels or wind, you had to be connected to the central system and you had to pay for that connection, and the central system wouldn't pay you for your excess energy you would deliver into the system.
Back on the fields of Jordi's farm, the repeal of the so-called sun tax is now allowing him to finally take advantage of the country's famously hot weather conditions. And as world leaders gathered in Madrid at the UN's Climate Change Congress in December, warning of sleepwalking past the point of no return as our planet heats, Spain hopes that its belated green energy boom could be part of the solution.
That was Tim Smith from the BBC. Coming up,
it felt safe to them. There was a lot of open housing. There were relatively plentiful jobs.
Doesn't sound like a bad place to relocate, right? But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks backed off some record highs on the next-to-last trading day of 2019, with investors taking profits against those recent gains. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 183 points, 0.6%, to close at 28,462. The Nasdaq fell 60 points, also 0.6%, to finish at 89.45, and the S&P 500 shed 18 points, more than 0.5%, to end at 32.21. The National Association of Realtors Pending Home Sales Index rose 1.2% in November. Even so, mortgage lender Bank of America dropped more than 0.5%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.88%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This is it, folks. Just a couple of days left in this decade, which means time is running out to support Marketplace and make it count for this year. Any donation makes you a Marketplace investor and a partner in our mission to make people smarter about this economy. And don't forget, if you give at least $60 or a monthly donation of $5 or more, you'll get exclusive access to our 2020 Ask Me Anything virtual event series. Find out more and donate at marketplace.org. And thanks.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. After years in the workforce, for many, there comes a time to retire, or at least dial things back. Which brings us to our series, My Economy, where this week we're hearing from folks in the fastest growing segment of the labor force, those older than 55. Today, we head to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where for one person, cutting back on work wasn't an easy decision.
My name is Trish Carney. I'm a part-time registered nurse, mostly retired. I live in Chattanooga, Tennessee. I think most of us go into nursing, you know, hoping to get paid for something that we enjoy doing. I was a stay-at-home mom for years and years and took care of kids, and I thought, gosh, you know, we need the income. I like taking care of people. I might as well, you know, be a nurse. It's just real nice to feel like you're helping somebody. When I was in nursing school in the late 90s, it was the second or third semester, my husband died. He actually committed suicide, and there was not really much of an option except to finish school because I had kids to support. The first semester back in school, after being out 20-something years, I got pregnant with my seventh child, so it took me a while to finish a two-year program, which ended up, you know, being about 4 or 5 years by the time I trickled through everything. But yeah, that's what I did, so... You just kind of work around your family's needs. You know, if I needed money, I could always pick up extra hours. You know, I could pick up a second job. And that has not been an option. Drawing Social Security, you're not allowed to earn more than a certain amount. And I'm afraid I may have gone over it this year. I'm not sure. I think there's some kind of first year thing. But I'm looking at my time, and I don't know what I'm going to do with free time. I've never really had any. As much as I hate to admit it, you know, things don't work as well when you get older. It's hard to keep up the pace. It takes a lot longer to do everything. The walk in the halls and floors and driving is just, you know, I just don't feel up to it anymore. I don't think I have any health problems, really. Just I'm a car with over 100,000 miles on it. It's time to retire.
That was Trish Carney in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Let us know what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org. For For this next story, we're heading to Lewiston, Maine. It's a former mill town, once a destination for French-Canadian immigrants who came looking for jobs. But today, Lewiston looks different. The mills are pretty much gone, though there is an L.L. Bean factory nearby. And the population is different, too. Nearly 20 years ago, Somali and Congolese refugees started moving in. Now, of the roughly 36,000 residents of the town, about 6,000 are former refugees. Cynthia Anderson writes about how they transformed Lewiston. It's a subject of her new book, Home Now. Cynthia, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Lewiston where we spend most of the time in your book is different than the Lewiston you knew growing up. Can you talk about the changes in the town even before this new wave of immigrants and refugees arrived?
Yes. So when I was growing up, Lewiston was just a really vibrant, vital place. Back then, Lisbon Street in Lewiston was the city's spine. The sidewalks were filled with families and couples. And, you know, we didn't know it then. This was the 70s. But already, Lisbon Street and by extension, Lewiston was in decline. The city's glory years as a textile and shoe manufacturer were fading. And that only continued when the first Somali refugees actually came north from Portland in the early 2000s. Lewiston was a devitalized city at that point.
Why in particular did refugees from Somalia and the Democratic Republic of Congo seem to gather in Lewiston?
Well, that is a good question because Lewiston, of course, is very cold. And again, I think it was in many ways, you know, coincidental in that there were a few folks in Portland and then they moved north. They sent out word that Lewiston was a good place to live. There, it felt safe to them. There was a lot of open housing. There were relatively plentiful jobs, at least, at the minimum wage level. And, folks just started gathering there, and the more who came, the more who wanted to come. So word went out that Lewiston was a good place to live.
You describe in your book how some of the people in Lewiston were quite welcoming of all the refugees and new immigrants, but some were not. Can you describe those reactions and what you think was behind them?
Yeah. So I think early on, there was a lot of wariness about who the newcomers were. I think there was a lot of concern initially about resources. You know, Lewiston is not a rich city, was not then a rich city. So I think a lot of longtime residents were concerned about whether there would be enough of kind of everything to go around. You know, then you also had probably an overlay of anti-Islamist sentiment. There have been incidents. I don't want to deny that. But there's what's really happened in Lewiston has been hard work by newcomers and longtime Lewistonians, and you know a kind of gradual, quiet acceptance.
There has been this tension about how the economy of Lewiston is doing more broadly. Who's benefited and who hasn't? Do Lewiston residents, immigrant or not, worry about things like housing and heating costs and low wages, or are people today feeling pretty good?
That's a pretty broad question. I'm not an economist, but I can say that there is unquestionably a feeling of vitality in the city that was not there two decades ago, or even a decade ago. There's no doubt that new immigrants are finding their way. Kids are going off to college in ever-rising numbers. The real question for Lewiston is whether there will be a sufficient number of living wage jobs for young people to come back and be able to support their families. And it's not just a question really for Lewiston, but for many small cities and towns in rural Maine and, you know, and around the nation.
Cynthia Anderson is the author of Home Now, How 6,000 Refugees Transformed an American Town. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We have an excerpt of the book for you on our website about what the arrival and growth of the Somali population felt like from the perspective of the local flower shop. Find that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out, a changing definition of what's considered heavy in the shipping industry. According to the Wall Street Journal, UPS and FedEx are slapping new fees on packages that weigh more than 50 pounds. Right now, only parcels more than 70 pounds get hit with the $24 surcharge. One analyst estimated the change will affect about 14.5% of packages, meaning retailers might split up orders of laundry detergent, big bags of dog food, or other heavy items into multiple shipments to avoid the fee. More boxes can still mean higher shipping costs for businesses and consumers, but it may make hauling those multiple jumbo boxes of kitty litter a little easier for delivery workers. We've got to go. Today, the Dow lost 183 points, 0.6%. The Nasdaq fell 60 points, also 0.6%. And the S&P 500 shed 18 points, more than 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. And I'm Kimberly Adams. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.